You are listening to the Mythmaker Podcast Network.
Now, 3500 BC is the beginning of high culture. At this date, we have the invention of writing. We have the invention of complicated mathematics based on the decimal system and on the sexagesimal system, the 60 system. We have the observation of the heavens, the notion of a cosmic order, which is mathematical. The idea of a mathematically determined universe, and the mathematics applying both to space and to time. The 60 circle of space and the 60 circle of time are the same 60 circle, and they reckon back and forth. Time and space are, so to say, the womb of the goddess within which all being exists. It's a fundamental concept. This is exactly what the Indians call Maya, or the realm of phenomenality. And this is exactly what Kant calls Maya, too. And as you know, the space-time reckonings of modern physics and astronomy carry this on. Also the idea of a mathematically determined universe. So from that date to this, this is the main idea. The only question is, what is the proper mathematics, which is still being fussed about. But the idea that through mathematics you can find the grain of the world, so to say, the order, the fate of life. It's the very goddess herself, mathematics. Earlier than that, we're in the realm of comparatively primitive thought. And this primitive thought will be of two orders, that associated with the plant world, that associated with the animal world. That associated with the plant world is recorded in archaeology through the diggings earlier than this of the hieratic city-state in the period that we call the Neolithic. Now that's the period that extends from the 7500 BC to 3500 BC in the Near East. And from that center, the art of grain agriculture goes out into the world. I divided it up into a few stages. The first being that of the beginnings, you might say, what I call proto-Neolithic, then a period that I call basal, where we are sure that everything is present that is characteristic of Neolithic, and finally high Neolithic, where we get very highly refined potteries. And these arts are then diffused. But we do not have kings for this period, we have villages. This is a world of village life. The high unit is the village. What happens to these villages when a king comes into being? What happens is the king conquers the villages, and these villages become then the servants of the main capital. They will be required to furnish certain goods to the king's court and the capital city's life. One will become a center for the making of pottery, high-style pottery. Another for furnishing horses or elephants. Within the palace, there are representatives of these different cities as required from the different villages as required from them. People who till the field, people who, this one village, for instance in Ceylon, that had the job of furnishing the king's barbers, and another who furnished his servants who brought the food in and so forth. That was the archaic way of society. But earlier than that, we have the sheer village itself. Now, there's a big question, and this is the thing I want to speak about now, as to whether this whole concept of food cultivation, the cultivation of your food, begins originally here or was brought to the Near East from the tropics. There are two types of early agriculture, of early planting. One, grain agriculture, which is from seed. And that is the agriculture of all of the high, the basic agriculture of all of the high societies. But down in the tropical world, we have roots and we have slits. plants that are reproduced by being just planting a little cutting. For instance, the banana, coconut also, a great big coconut plant, a sago palm, taro, yams, potato. All of this, the primitive gardening, we call this. Now there are three views with respect to this problem. One, that the actual beginning of the idea of cultivation of food is in the Near East. It is diffuse. And when it reaches tropical zones like this, it is applied to these tropical plants. The second is, of course, just the opposite of this, that it all begins in the tropics with tropical planting and goes from the tropics into the temperate zones where the seed planting is developed. And the third, of course, is that these are two entirely separate developments. Now, with respect to the primitive planting being the earlier, there's a man, Carl Sauer, who was and perhaps still is at the University of California in Berkeley, who believes that planting was first developed in Southeast Asia, right where we're having our Vietnam War now, and in Thailand, a very rich country, actually, agriculturally. His belief is that this development could have taken place as early as 50,000 BC. That breaks all records. And he arrived at his conception on the basis of the distribution of cultivated plants and the distribution of the wild plants in which the cultivated plants are developed. The idea he has is that fishing people on those great rivers there, and this is a river world to this day in Southeast Asia, fishing people supplemented a fish diet with these highly carbohydrate types of food. That it was the women who first cultivated these plants, and that plants were also cultivated for fish poisons, to poison the water so that the fish would be killed in great batches. Now I'm becoming more and more seduced into this theory, now that they're beginning to find rather early dates for planting in America. Within the past 5 or 6 years, the development of maize has been pushed back to something like 2000 BC, where it's formally the first planting, the first cultivated plant in the New World had been found in Peru with a date 1016 BC, and it was an Asian plant, namely cotton. It could be. Now, according to that view, this would go north to China, and China would be a realm of independent grain development. South China, rice. Would go into the highlands of Western Asia, where the wheat and oats and other grains are developed, and would also go into Abyssinia, which is highlands of East Africa, and certain developments take place there. Furthermore, in association with this gardening, there are three animals, household animals. You wouldn't think of them at all as household animals right now, but go to any primitive little village and you'll see that they are. They're right in the house. Chickens, which come from India, the pig, and the dog. The distribution of dogs, the dog in Australia, for example, the dogs in America, and the dogs in Asia and Europe, would suggest a Southeast Asian source. The distribution of the cult of the pig, and the fact that the lice on European pigs are of Asian origin suggests something like this. Then when you get up into the highlands, you have a shift, not only to grain agriculture, but also to cattle. cultivation of animals is a quite different kind of domestication of animals. Like, you don't have the cattle living in the houses with people. So this is going to remain just a problem. And now I'm going to repeat something that I spoke of when I was introducing the course to all of you last year. Wherever you have planting or agriculture, you have the cult of the goddess as the dominant cult. You have the power of the woman in relation to the fertilization of the earth by imitative magic, by the association of the woman's giving birth and nourishment to children with the earth's production of plants and food. The woman then becomes the proper priestess of the goddess. We have then priestess societies. The male is secondary here. Now it's in these societies that the inferiority, if there's one thing, you all learn it sooner or later, that the male has very strongly in him, it's a will to be on top. The aggression and the ego drive is very strong. And in this kind of situation, he's got a good basis for an inferiority complex. And what he does about this is to form that great new invention, the men's secret society, where no women are allowed. And this men's secret society is characteristic of the mother right cultures, particularly conspicuous along the line of the tropics, which is the area where the plant world furnishes the main image for life. Let me just now speak about these two. The world of the woman, the world of the vegetable and food and productivity. In terms of the vegetable world, what we have is the image of decay yielding life, the death and resurrection of the out of death comes life. That is the basic mythology which Fraser expresses here. The whole context of Fraser's work is this of the out of death comes life. Again by association, but this is not an association which he points. The association of the rot of the forest and jungle out of which life comes. So to increase life, kill, kill, kill. You make a kind of mulch of human flesh out of which human life comes back. And the rites of murder and killing in the tropical world, all the way from West Africa, right across South Asia, Southeast Asia, the Oceania, into America, Brazil, the African world, are horrendous. That's one context in this culture world. Another point is that the individual, which is the male interest, doesn't count. All of mother's children are pretty okay. Johnny and Billy are having an argument, but Johnny always wins, but mother loves Billy just as well. It doesn't matter whether he's right or dumb, he's mine. And this attitude toward individual idiosyncrasies in the rather large village context is rather sort of democratic. Anybody is as good as anybody else, and the best ones we like to get rid of by using them as our chief sacrifice. So you have a kind of anti-individualism there. Whereas in the male societies, the individual is something that is appreciated to be able to win. So this is what comes up in these secret societies. I don't know whether I've spoken about this yet, but what were the males doing that was so damned important? Well, what they were doing was raising pigs. Male pigs. And there's a specific kind of activity associated with pigs. Now you can play dominoes and things like that in men's clubs. But what was done in these clubs was to knock the upper incisors, upper canine teeth out of the animal's mouth, so that the lower tusk could grow without interference, and it would grow out in a long, moon-like loop. This loop would go all around and loop back through the jaw again. And now the pig is in great pain from now on, so he doesn't put on meat. That means he's a spiritual pig. The tusk goes right through the jaw and comes out and around again. And to get three loops on your pig makes you something like a 32nd degree mason. You can carry the name of he who walks on clouds, and you can do this when you enter the dumbest secret society line. At each stage in the growth of the tusk, a great many pigs are slain that belong to this man. So you see how busy he has to be getting these pigs going. And with each of these growths, stage and growth, the man can change his name. He puts on a great pig-killing party, pig-sacrificing party, and he is rising in the scale. Meanwhile, this pig is becoming more and more identified with his own character. The pig becomes the intermediary between the individual and his own high spiritual state. Now, when he dies, that pig is buried with him. And that pig is his substitute offering to, guess whom? The goddess who guards the passage to the underworld. She stands there, and he approaches with his pig. Instead of her eating him, she will eat the pig, provided he knows certain secrets. As he approaches, she draws on the ground a labyrinth design. And when he is halfway there, she erases half of it, and he has to complete the labyrinth design. And no one who does not know how to complete the labyrinth design can go through the underworld labyrinth to the realm of eternal life. Where did he learn the completion of the labyrinth design? In the men's secret society. So if you want an eternal life, there's only one way to get it. You have to learn the secrets of the underworld, what the formulae are for getting through the doors and so forth, and you have to have with you your sacrificial animal. And when you realize that the story of Theseus in Crete has to do with the labyrinth, has to do with the girl at the gates of the labyrinth, namely Ariadne, who enables her hero to go in through and come forth again in that case, but get through with all that these earlier people want. You realize that we're on a beam here that belongs not only to the primitive world, but to the high world as well. The boar becomes your animal substitute, the animal representation of your own potential status in the underworld. And now we just carry that on up. It's the lunar animal, having to do with the death and immortality. Death and resurrection is read in two ways. One, you die and you come back on earth. Two, you die and you have eternal life in the underworld. That's what the boar says. The boar, the labyrinth, the idea of the sacrifice, the surrogate sacrifice. Now, in later contexts or in other contexts, the boar becomes the bull. While Moses was up with the thunder god, Aaron was down with the golden calf. And the lamb, goat, chicken, or, in some very, very high-powered rites, what is killed is not the pig, but a boy. And very often, these boys who are raised to be sacrificed are the man's own son by a concubine. You see what the context we're in here. This is the same one phrase that we're talking about on a primitive level. Now we simply come to this question as to whether this is an independent growth, whether it is a very early growth, whether it is the source of the higher tradition, or whether it is simply a remote colonial tropical restatement of something that had a higher beginning. Those are all open questions. We just don't know the answers.